Hello and welcome to Vanguard Audiobooks. This is part of the Learning College that we're doing at VNN. I'm Alex Linder, and everything that we do here as part of the Learning College at VNN can be found at vnnforum.com. Today what we're going to do are three more chapters in The Fame of a Dead Man's Deeds, which is a portrait of the late William Luther Pierce. Today we're going to talk about the Turner Diaries. Chapter 10, The Turner Diaries. Chapter 11, Pierce on the Turner Diaries, and Chapter 12, Timothy McVeigh, and this will take about 25-30 pages, so probably hour and a half or so in this particular segment of our audiobook. Previously, we've done introduction, early life, the biography and marriages, children, career, Bildung, as the Germans call it, as well as the sources of political inspiration, George Bernard Shaw and Nietzsche and Savitri Devi and others who made William Pierce what he is, and now we're turning to his life as the creator of the National Alliance, out of the old National Youth Alliance that was associated with Carto and Youth for Wallace. And we came across Revelo Oliver last chapter, who is a classics professor at the University of Illinois, who introduced to Pierce the idea of writing fiction through a book he gave him, the John Franklin Letters, which the Turner Diaries was somewhat similar to. So Pierce had never thought of writing fiction until that point. So now we're going to talk about Pierce's most famous work, the Turner Diaries, which was published as a serial in his Attack tabloid that he ran in the 1970s. And then later, after he was done, he published it, after 3 years of it appearing in serialized form, he published it as a book. And then later it was farmed out to Lyle Stewart. But Stewart was a Jew publisher in New York with Barricade Books. Barricade went bankrupt, and the rights reverted to Pierce. So supposedly several hundred thousand copies of the Turner Diaries have been sold, and it's been read by at least hundreds of thousands, if not a couple million people. So, significant book. The media falsely blames it for what happened at Oklahoma City, where the government had agents. SPLC had agents. The FBI had agents. But we'll get into all that. Anyway, we're going to find out about the Turner Diaries, what it is, and then Pierce's views of it, and then Tim McVeigh. So without further ado, let's turn to chapters 10 to 12. Chapter 10, The Turner Diaries, page 143. Pierce wrote The Turner Diaries, as well as his later novel, Hunter, under the pen name Andrew MacDonald. His approach paralleled that taken by Revelo Oliver, I am certain it was Oliver, in the John Franklin Letters, repeats Griffin from what he more or less said last chapter. The preface of the John Franklin Letters is written by the fictitious Professor Harley Ogden, and the foreword in Pierce's book is written by MacDonald. Where Pierce differs from Oliver is that he makes MacDonald the author of the book, while Oliver left his book without an identified author. The premise of the Turner Diaries is that MacDonald is writing the preface of the book in the year 100 of the new era, which, if I have it calculated right, is 2099 by our numbering. MacDonald tells us that there was an insurrectionary group in this country called the Organization. In Oliver's book, it was the Rangers, which successfully waged the Great Revolution against the system. It was the bureaus in the bureaucrats in the Franklin Letters during the period from 1991 to 1999. Recall that Pierce wrote the tabloid episodes that became the Turner Diaries in the mid-1970s, so it'd be like setting events in a book written these years in 2015 or 2020, that is 15, 20 years ahead. Where you are. It lends a prophetic quality to the writing. The outcome of this great revolution, we learn in the preface, was a, quote, cataclysmic upheaval, unquote, not only in America, but all over the world, which resulted in the new era. This was such a monumental turn of events that the years are numbered from that time forward. 1NE, 2NE, 3NE, and so on, similar to the French Revolution. What they tried to do and others have tried to do. What has happened, writes MacDonald, is that the excavations of the, quote, Washington ruins, unquote, have turned up, this is 100 NE, remember, a historically significant diary that had been kept by one of the martyrs of the Great Revolution. I find it interesting that Pierce uses the word martyr and not hero. a man named Earl Turner. This was a significant discovery because Turner is a major historical figure. Schoolchildren memorize his name along with others on the Record of Martyrs, and he is recognized every year on the Day of the Martyrs. This book marks the Turner Diaries' first availability to the general public. So 100 years after the Revolution, they find this diary of someone who was known to be a hero, called a martyr in the Great Revolution against the system. Earl Turner, we are told, was a rank-and-file member of the organization, as well as its elite cadre, the Order. MacDonald informs us that Turner kept a diary from the beginning of the Revolution in September of 1991 to the day of his death, November 9th, 1993, when he flew an old crop duster plane on what amounted to a suicide mission to drop a nuclear bomb in the Pentagon building in Washington, D.C. The bomb hit its target, and Turner achieved a kind of immortality as one of the great martyrs. He will be honored by all of the generations to come for his enormous dedication, courage, and sacrifice, and for the gift of a grand new way of being that he and others like him made possible. MacDonald tells us that Turner was 35 years old when he began writing the diaries. Turner grew up in Los Angeles, was trained as an electrical engineer, and after college settled in Washington, D.C. area, the center of things for Pierce since the Rockwell connection, where he worked for an electronics research firm. Turner's diary entries recount his exploits in the Great Revolution, along with those of his compatriots in the organization. George, Henry, and the woman who becomes Turner's mate, the word Pierce used, Catherine. MacDonald doesn't give the reader any indication in the preface, nor do we get it later on in the book, of what any of these individuals looks like, with the exception that he gets across the idea that Catherine is a physically attractive woman. Earl Turner's first diary entry is dated September 16th, 1991. Quote, "Today it finally began. After all those years of talking and doing nothing, we have finally taken our first action. We are at war with the system, and it is no longer a war of words." Turner refers to having been arrested in the gun raids 2 years before. The Cohen Act, in the John Franklin letters it was the Javits Act, another Jewish name, had outlawed private ownership of guns. Four Negroes had burst into Turner's door with a baseball bat and knives and ransacked his apartment looking for a gun. Their white superior found it, in Pierce's writing, "Don't expect minorities to get anything done," and Turner was arrested. So many people were arrested in the gun raids, about 800,000 nationwide, that the authorities didn't have the means to process them all. So after 3 days of detention in a high school gym, Turner was released. He lost his position at the laboratory when he was arrested, however, and did consulting work and special jobs for a couple of electronic firms to make a living. Pierce may have been drawing on his own situation here. His job at Pratt & Whitney ended, albeit at his initiative, but in his mind he jumped before he was pushed, with his transgression, publishing National Socialist World, which is what he did after meeting George Lincoln Rockwell. And there were 6 issues of that he eventually published, for ceasing it. When the gun raids had taken place 2 years before, some militant members of the organization, Turner records in his diary, were in favor of, quote, "digging up our weapons caches and unleashing a program of terror against the system immediately, carrying out executions of federal judges, newspaper editors, legislators, and other system figures. The time was ripe for such an action," they felt, because in the wake of the gun raids, they could win public sympathy for such a campaign against tyranny. But they were wrong, Turner concludes. The organization wasn't ready to act effectively. At that time, Turner writes, the organization contained too many cowards, blabbermouths, informers, fools, weaklings, irresponsible jerks, faint hearts, and hobbyists. But now they are ready. What will come to be called the Great Revolution has begun. Turner's unit, Pierce's National Alliance, is divided into units, as was the John Birch Society, Pierce's first organizational link, needs to raise some cash, so they rob Berman's liquor store and make off with $800. In the process, Earl bops a black employee over the head with an ivory special, a bar of soap and a sock. This socially conscious, quote-unquote, crime, robbing a liquor store, may have inspired Bob Matthews, who will be discussed later on, to devise his own similarly inspired money-raising enterprises. They then go down the street to Berman's Deli. Earl gives old man Berman a bop. Henry then slits Berman's throat from ear to ear. When Mrs. Berman enters the scene, Henry lets fly with a jar of kosher pickles, and she goes down in a spray of pickles and broken glass, which is a quote. That robbery netted another $4,426. Earl reports that he isn't up for robbing any more liquor stores because, quote, I don't have the nerves for it, unquote. Note that nerves were Earl's problem. He had no moral qualms about an old man having his throat cut and his wife getting a rock-hard jar rifled into her face. In the Turner Diaries, Pierce makes explicit what was tacit in Oliver's book. The organization is waging a struggle on behalf of the white race. This is a race war. Quote, if the organization fails at its task now, Turner writes, everything will be lost. Our white history, our heritage, all the blood and sacrifices and upward striving of countless thousands of years, the enemy we are fighting fully intends to destroy the basis of our existence. Unquote. The Turner Diaries is replete with violence from beginning to end, particularly when revenge is being wreaked against Jews and blacks and traitorous whites, men and women, young and old. An early entry tells of an organization member dying in a Chicago jail, probably, Turner surmises, at the hands of black inmates, while the white authorities look the other way. In retaliation, a member of the organization blows off the head of the Cook County Sheriff with a shotgun. When a spokesman for the Chicago Jewish community responds by describing the organization as, quote, a gang of racist bigots, unquote, his head is chopped off with a hatchet. My guess is that beyond whatever service violent incidents like these provide to the book's narrative line, writing them gave Pierce a measure of cathartic relief. With this kind of thing going on in Chicago and elsewhere, the Attorney General of the United States announces that the FBI is going to root out the organization, which he describes as, quote, depraved racist criminals, unquote, who want to, quote, undo all the progress toward true equality, unquote, that has been attained by the system in recent years. Earl reports that he and Catherine, who up to this point had been aligned with George, even though she wasn't George's mate, accidentally meet unclothed in the shower, and nature takes its course. From then on, they are together. Turner describes Catherine as having herself been arrested in the gun raids. She had purchased a pistol after her roommate had been raped by a black. She met George in the detention center, and he had radicalized her. Before she met George, Catherine had been a liberal, quote, in the mindless, automatic way that most people are, unquote. George gave her books to read and helped her develop a racial identity. This theme of being educated into racial consciousness by someone who, among other things, provides books for them to read is a recurrent theme in Pierce's writing. No doubt it grows out of his sense of the central importance of this kind of education and his view of himself as a teacher. In a way, Professor Pierce has never left the classroom. Catherine had worked in the past as a congressman's secretary and a copy editor and writer. In the organization, she specializes in makeup and disguises. Another theme in Pierce, when women are doing what they should be doing, it is not going to be writing or editing articles. Women serve their men. Now we come to the incident in the book that received so much attention in the Timothy McVeigh case. Many believe it is what inspired McVeigh to blow up the Murrah Federal Building in Oklahoma City in the way that he did. Turner's unit is assigned to blow up the FBI headquarters in Washington. The objective is to strike before the FBI arrests more organization members. In particular, the revolutionaries want to knock out a computer complex in the sub-basement of the building that supports a new internal passport system which will expose to arrest organization legals, quote unquote, those who have not gone underground. So they like Sinn Féin, they'd have an above ground and they'd have an underground. Secondary objectives of the bombing are to raise morale in the organization by demonstrating its ability to act and to embarrass the system. Another unit in the organization has been assigned to get the explosives. Turner's unit will hijack a truck making a delivery to the FBI headquarters, load the truck with explosives, drive to a freight receiving area, set a fuse, and leave the truck before the bomb goes off. Turner's unit is to work out the details of the assignment, which includes determining the FBI's freight delivery schedules and procedures. Turner's specific job is to design and construct the mechanism that detonates the bomb. Here we see another theme, and ideal in Pierce's writing. People unquestioningly doing what they are told in the service of a grand race-enhancing mission. Turner writes that he first put together a trigger mechanism, which he said was, quote, quite easy, unquote, to construct, although he doesn't go into details about how he went about it. He says he held up on the booster. The trigger mechanism needs a booster to set off the main charge, 5 or 10 tons of explosive like TNT, until he knew what sort of explosives he would be using. The unit assigned to acquire the explosives steal 2 cases, around 100 pounds of blasting gelatin, which is the booster he needs. Turner says the blasting gelatin is sensitive enough to be initiated by one of his homemade lead azide detonators, and that the 100 pounds he has is enough to set off the main charge, which turns out to be around 4,400 pounds of ammonium nitrate fertilizer, along with 400 pounds of dynamite. Writes Turner, block quote here, I packed about 4 pounds of the blasting gelatin into an empty applesauce can, primed it, and placed the batteries and timing mechanism in the top of the can, and wired them to a small toggle switch on the end of the 20-foot extension cord. When we load the truck with explosives, the can will go in the back, on top of the 2 cases of blasting gelatin. We'll have to poke small holes in the walls of the trailer and the cab to run the extension cord and the switch into the cab. End of the block quote. Turner says that someone, probably Henry, will drive the truck into the freight receiving area inside the FBI building, flip a switch which starts a timer, and 10 minutes later the explosives will go off. Since the amount of explosives is relatively small, it is decided that it would be best to try to get the truck into the first level basement, which has a freight entrance. Another block quote. If we detonate our bomb in the basement underneath the courtyard, the confinement will make it substantially more effective. It will almost certainly collapse the basement floor into the sub-basement, burying the computers. Furthermore, it will destroy most, if not all, communications and power equipment for the building, since those are in the basement levels. The big unknown is whether it will do enough structural damage to the building to make it uninhabitable for an extended period. Without a detailed blueprint of the building and a team of architects and civil engineers, we simply can't answer that question. End of block quote. Quote, if we are lucky, Turner writes in his diary, quote, that will be the end of the FBI building and the government's new $3 billion computer complex for their internal passport system. Close quote. Note there is no consideration for the lives that might be lost in the blast, says Griffin. Turner and the ordnance expert of the other unit involved in the operation, Ed Sanders, calculate that they would need at least 10,000 pounds of TNT, or an equivalent explosive, to destroy a substantial portion of the FBI building and wreck the new computer center. To be on the safe side, they ask for 20,000 pounds. Turner finally has to make do with a little under 5,000 pounds, however, and most of that is not TNT, but rather ammonium nitrate fertilizer. He says that when it is sensitized with oil and tightly confined, ammonium nitrate makes an effective blasting agent, although he considers it less effective for their purposes than TNT would have been. The day of the bombing, Turner and Sanders mix heating oil with the 100-pound bags of ammonium nitrate fertilizer in the other unit's garage. Here's another block quote. We stood the 100-pound bags on end one by one and poked a small hole in the top with a screwdriver, just big enough to insert the end of a funnel. While I held the bag in the funnel, Ed poured in a gallon of oil. Then we slapped a big square of adhesive tape over the hole, and I turned the bag end over end to mix the contents while Ed refilled his oil can from the feeder line to the oil furnace. It took us nearly 3 hours to do all 44 sacks, and the work really wore me out. While this is going on, George and Henry are out stealing a truck. They find one, a delivery truck of an office supply firm, and Henry kills its black driver with a knife. Henry drives the truck back to where Turner and Sanders are, with George following in a car. They unload what was in the delivery truck, and then load the now empty truck with the cases of dynamite and bags of ammonium nitrate fertilizer, sensitized by adding heating oil. Turner runs the cable and switch for the detonator from the cargo area into the cab of the truck and through a crack. They decide to leave the driver's body in the back of the truck. Henry drives the truck toward the FBI building. At 9:15 a.m., the bomb goes off. Turner writes in his diary, block quote, the pavement shuddered violently under our feet. An instant later, the blast wave hit us, a deafening kavoom, followed by An enormous roaring, crashing sound, accentuated by the higher-pitched noise of shattering glass all around us. The plate glass windows in the store beside us and dozens of others that we could see along the street were blown to splinters. A glittering and deadly rain of glass shards continued to fall into the street from the upper stories of nearby buildings for a few seconds as a jet-black column of smoke shot straight up into the sky ahead of us. Turner and George run to the building. Another block quote. The scene in the courtyard was one of utter devastation. The whole Pennsylvania Avenue wing of the building had collapsed, partly into the courtyard in the center of the building, and partly into Pennsylvania Avenue. A huge hole yawned in the courtyard pavement just beyond the rubble of collapsed masonry, and it was from this hole that most of the column of black smoke was ascending. Overturned trucks and automobiles, smashed office furniture, and building rubble were strewn wildly about, and so were the bodies of a shockingly large number of victims. Over everything hung a pall of black smoke, burning our eyes and lungs and reducing the bright morning to semi-darkness. End the quote. Turner reports that he, quote, gaped with a mixture of horror and elation at the devastation. Unquote. Turner hears a moan and sees a girl about 20 years of age trapped in the rubble, half conscious, her face smudged and cut, her leg broken with a deep gash in her thigh. He puts a tourniquet on her thigh wound and carries her out to the street. He then becomes aware of the moans and screams of dozens of other victims. He looks upon a woman, her face covered in blood, and with a gaping wound in her head, lying motionless, quote, a horrible sight, unquote, he writes. Turner later learns that approximately 700 people died from the blast. For the first time in the book, Turner confronts the issue of the justification of causing the deaths of so many innocent people. Block quote here. There is no way we can destroy the system without hurting many thousands of innocent people. No way. It is a cancer too deeply rooted in our flesh. And if we don't destroy the system before it destroys us, if we don't cut this cancer out of our living flesh, our whole race will die. We are all completely convinced that what we did was justified, but it is still very hard to see our own people suffering so intensely because of our acts. It is because Americans have for so many years been unwilling to make unpleasant decisions that we are forced to make decisions now which are stern indeed. End of the quote. The unpleasant decisions he refers to are with reference to the Jewish and race issues that threaten the preservation of a white America. Not long after the FBI bombing, Turner is informed that he had been deemed worthy of being brought into a select inner circle of the organization, the Order. Turner is given what looks like a monk's robe to wear and stands in a circle with five similarly robed organization members for the initiation ceremony. As members of the Order, they are to be bearers of the cause, the survival and progress of their race. Turner and the others swear the oath to the cause and allegiance to one another. The experience, Turner reports, quote, shook me to my bones and raised the hair on the back of my neck, unquote. Now his life belongs only to the Order. Quote, today I was, in a sense, born again, unquote, he writes. I know now that I will never again be able to look at the world or the people around me or my own life in quite the same way I did before. Griffin now. As I read this section of the book, I imagine that it must have been gratifying for Pierce, who I believe has always felt quite alone, to write about Turner, who is Pierce, really. The book is Pierce writing out his own fantasies, his own wishes, having his life become intertwined with others in service to something larger than their individual interests and pursuits. It must have been satisfying for Pierce to write about the others being as committed as Turner is to achieving this grand purpose, and to write about the others giving Turner their loyalty and support, and Turner giving his loyalty and support to them in return. I think being part of an order-like group is what Pierce, or better, a part of him, would like in his life. He heads an organization, the National Alliance, and supervises its employees, but I think he dreams of being a valued follower, a rank-and-file member, as Turner is in this book. I said part of him in the first sentence of this paragraph because as much as Pierce wants to be embedded in something bigger than he is, when it comes down to it, he is a loner and wants to call the shots in his life. Since Pierce broke with Matt Cale and the NSWPP in 1970, even though he has worked in the context of an organization, the National Youth Alliance, which became the National Alliance, in a very real sense, he has worked alone. This was true even when Kevin Strom was with him. It appears that Strom worked more under Pierce than alongside him. and never really with Pierce in any truly bonded way. From what I have picked up from Pierce, his relationship with Strom was more akin to that of like-minded colleagues than fused brothers as in the Order. At present, Pierce has subordinates and followers, and people do things around him. I'm thinking of the activities of the local units in the National Alliance, but he really doesn't have comrades in arms as far as I have been able to see. My read on Pierce is that he goes back and forth. He wants to be intertwined with others, and at the same time he doesn't, and that the latter of the two impulses wins out. However, the other impulse, the desire to be a, quote, good soldier, unquote, is still there in Pierce, and it manifests itself in this section of the Turner Diaries. The rest of the book goes back and forth between what amounts to many lectures by Turner slash Pierce on the state of the world and increasingly horrific acts of violence on the part of the organization. Briefly, some of the lectures. And he has some bullet points here. A bunch of them. Liberalism is an infantile, pseudo-sophisticated, submissive worldview that is alien to white people. It is an, quote, egalitarian plague, unquote. Conservatism is a reformist mentality that either won't or can't come to grips with the deep futility of the current social arrangements and the need to build something radically and fundamentally different in its place. The women's movement is an aberration promoted by the system to divide white men and women and thus set the race off against itself. Blacks have exerted an increasingly degenerative influence on white culture. In order to live in a wholesome way that is natural to whites, whites need their own living space, completely separate from blacks. Most Americans are drowning in a flood of Jewish liberal propaganda in the media, the schools, and the churches, and don't even realize it. They have become soft, materialistic herd animals, true Democrats, without racial identity and loyalty, and without heroic toughness and spirit. We need to dare envision walking the streets and seeing only, quote, clean, happy, enthusiastic white faces, determined and hopeful for the future. We need to imagine what it would be like if the streets were ours again. And some examples of this violence. The Washington Post offices are bombed and one of its Jewish editorial writers is blown in half with two blasts from a sawed-off shotgun. One of the organization's members is executed for refusing an assignment to assassinate a priest and a rabbi who have advocated race mixing. Mortar shells rain down on the Capitol in Washington, killing 61, quote, beautiful blossoms, quote, magnificent spectacle, another quote. A bazooka shoots down an airliner headed for Tel Aviv. Three young black males and one of the two white girls with them are killed with a crowbar. The other girl is shot and killed as she tries to flee. The Israeli embassy is mortared, leaving nothing but a burned-out heap of wreckage and killing all but a few of the 300 people inside. Houston is bombed, killing 4,000 and leaving much of Houston's industrial and shipping facilities a smoldering wreckage. Later explosions close the Houston airport, destroy the city's main power generating station, and collapse two strategically located overpasses and a bridge. Blacks are shot at random all over the country amid shouts of white power, and we're still in the bullet points. Execution squads shoot, stab, and beat Jews whose bodies are found strewn on sidewalks, alleys, and in apartment building hallways. Jews and everyone who looks as if he has some non-white ancestry are marched off in columns on a, quote, no return, unquote, march to a canyon. Nuclear blasts kill 14 million people outright in New York City, with another 5 million expected to die of burns or radiation. The most widely discussed episode in the book, The Day of the Rope, quote, unquote, the whites in Los Angeles who have, quote, betrayed their race, unquote, meet their fate. Turner writes in his diary, block quote here, August 1st, 1993. Today was the day of the rope. The night is filled with silent horrors. From tens of thousands of lampposts, power poles, and trees throughout this vast metropolitan area, the grisly forms hang. At practically every street corner I passed this evening on my way to headquarters, there was a dangling corpse, four at every intersection. Hanging from a single overpass, only about a mile from here, is a group of about 30, each with an identical placard around its neck, bearing the printed legend, I betrayed my race. In the middle of one of the unlighted blocks, I saw what appeared to be a person standing on the sidewalk directly in front of me. As I approached the silent figure, whose features were hidden in the shadow of a large tree overhanging the sidewalk, it remained motionless, blocking my way. Then, when I was within a dozen feet of the figure, which had been facing away from me, it began turning slowly toward me. I saw the horribly bloated, purplish face of a young woman, her eyes wide open and bulging, her mouth agape. Finally, I could make out the thin vertical line of a rope disappearing into the branches above. End of the block quote, as we move on to page 153. The last of Turner's diary entries is dated November 9th, 1933. He writes, "It's still 3 hours until first light and all systems are go. This is the day Turner will fly off in his old crop duster plane and, staying very low to the ground, destroy the Pentagon with a nuclear bomb. He will lose his life in the process and achieve the recognition and gratitude of his race forever." Catherine had been killed a couple of months before in a shootout with blacks that had begun when one of the blacks had made a sexual advance on her. Turner had been separated from the order because, while a captive, he had broken his oath. He had revealed information about the order after being tortured at the direction of a member of Israeli military intelligence instead of taking the cyanide that he had been given to use in such a circumstance. Turner escaped his captors and was put on trial and convicted by an order tribunal. He was told that his probationary status in the order would be extended. He had not yet gone through the rite of union that would make him a full member. If he took on the mission on which he was to embark, a mission, quote, whose successful completion can reasonably be expected to result in your death, unquote. Just before the mission, he would be allowed to participate in the rite of union and become a full member of the order. 2 days before this last day of his life, Turner had undergone the order's rite of union. In his last diary entry, he describes the others who participated in the ceremony as, quote, real men, white men, men who are now one with me in spirit and consciousness as well as in blood, unquote. He notes that the plane's engine has been warming up for about 10 minutes and that he was being signaled that it was time to go. The diary ends at this point. In the epilogue, McDonald tells us that Turner's mission was successful, but that he lost his life in the undertaking. The war raged on, with tens of millions perishing. McDonald notes that in the process, quote, millions of soft, city-bred, brainwashed whites gradually began regaining their manhood. On January 30, 1999, the organization achieved total victory and the Truce of Omaha was signed. Then came the mopping up exercise. Quote, the last of the non-white bands were hunted down and exterminated, followed by the final purge of undesirable racial elements among the remaining white population. The conflict then spread worldwide, and a white government came to control the world on the Great Ones, Hitler's, 110th birthday, April 20th, 1999. Hitler's dream is realized. As for Earl Turner, he has been a gallant warrior for his race, and he will live on in the minds of his people as long as they exist. And that's the end of Chapter 10 and the description of the contents of the Turner Diaries. Next, we'll turn to Chapter 11 and Pierce on the Turner Diaries. Quote, you know what the first line of your obituary is going to be, don't you? I said to Pierce. Well, it depends on when I die, before or after the revolution, he answered. Let's say before the revolution. And you're talking about in the New York Times. Yes, it is sure to say something like, William Pierce, author of the white supremacist novel, The Turner Diaries, died today. I would assume that just about everybody links you up with that book, especially with all the notoriety around the Tim McVeigh connection. Probably to a lot of people, you and the book are synonymous. Yes, I realize that at this point anyway. I'm pretty much identified with the Turner Diaries in people's minds. Griffin, when you talked to Revelo Oliver, he said you had to get to the people who only do recreational reading. Was that your audience for this book? I did think that this kind of book would get to people who wouldn't be likely to read my other material. Initially, at least, the people who got into the book were predominantly those who don't read much besides adventure fiction. But then, of course, the book began getting publicity, and other people wanted to see what the fuss was about. So eventually, the book got read by many different types of people. Although I must say that many of the lower-class white people who are affected by the book are not the kinds of people I am trying to recruit, because they are not particularly useful people. They don't have good character, and they aren't really strong and capable people. But I did reach some very fine people through the book who I'm sure I wouldn't have otherwise. I think the main thing, though, is that the book made a big impact on the public consciousness. It's become a household word. There was a story I read in the Village Voice, a newspaper in New York City. About 6 months ago, there was a fellow named Turner, Harry Turner, I think it was, who was a highway commissioner or something like that, some political job. He was caught up in some kind of scandal or controversy. Anyway, the headline in the article had Turner Diaries in it. I guess they thought that would be a cute headline. But really, the book had nothing to do with the story. It was just that this guy's name was Turner, and the headline writer figured that everybody would get the reference. I read that, and I thought to myself, we've arrived. In parentheses here. Another example of how the Turner Diaries and Pierce seemingly have entered the mainstream culture. In the 1999 Jeff Bridges film, Arlington Road, as in Pierce's book, the FBI headquarters building in Washington is blown up and a delivery truck is involved. Also, the Bridges character's wife is killed tracking down an extreme right-wing figure in West Virginia by the name of Parsons. I think you're right, I concurred. The Turner Diaries has had an impact on the public consciousness, but I do think that the associations most people have are very negative ones. At least the people I tend to be around, I'm talking about middle-class professional types, people who see themselves as informed, enlightened, reasonable, and moral, say to me, I've got no time to read that ignorant, racist garbage, nor do I have any time for anybody who produces that sort of material. How could somebody have written such a hateful, violent book? What in the world did he think he was doing? How do you respond to people like that? What do you say to them? Quote from Pierce. The Turner Diaries and Hunter and everything else I write are not pieces of propaganda designed by marketing experts. They'd say, here are the elements you need to have in it, and here's what you have to avoid. Punch these buttons to appeal to the housewives, and these over here to get the small businessmen, and so forth. I didn't do that. I suppose I might have tried to write in that sort of calculated way, and I'm not sure how it would have come out. As far as I went in that direction was to buy into Oliver's idea that I ought to try fiction as a medium to get my message across. What I did with the Turner Diaries was imagine myself a member of a revolutionary organization, Earl Turner. I put myself inside his skin and looked at the fictional situation I had created through his eyes. Or maybe it is through my eyes. It is kind of me as Earl and Earl as me. Anyway, I tried to imagine how I would react to the various situations he was in, what I would do, and how other people in the organization would react and behave, and proceeded from there. What came out of that is going to get a more sympathetic reading from people with a similar mentality to mine. I understand that. This book is not going to get a big response from somebody who has a basically mercantile outlook or a feminist conditioned turn of mind. It isn't going to get a receptive response from, say, an intelligent person who is concerned about all the problems he sees around him. Racial conflict, the effects of an economic globalization, the deindustrialization of the country, the breakdown of morality in America, the negative influence of television and the other media, but who just wants those problems to go away without it putting him out or having things get messy. He's worried about crime because it keeps him from enjoying his life in the way he would like. His business has been held up or burglarized a couple of times. Now that is a hell of a big nuisance to him. It costs a lot for insurance, for one thing. He'd like somebody to do something about all these problems, that's for sure. But really, he doesn't give a damn about the fundamental things I was concerned with in the Turner Diaries. He just wants the problems fixed so he can enjoy his life without interference. People like that aren't going to take to the book. They're going to say, oh my God, a revolution. Oh, that would be bad for business, terrible for profits. Or they turn pale at the idea of all the bloodshed and suffering and violence that goes along with cleaning up the mess we're in. And that is in the book, but I wasn't putting that in because I'm bloodthirsty or an anarchist or just trying to shock anybody. It's there because I think that is the way history works, that when the old order gives way to the new order, usually there is widespread bloodshed, suffering, and chaos. So I just wrote it the way I imagine things like this would happen. Now, if I wanted to appeal to your average middle-class consumer, then I would have described the problems the Turner Diaries deals with in a muted, euphemistic way. And then I would have had a knight on a white horse politician appear on the scene. We could both think of some possibilities to use as a prototype for this character. And he'd win the election and fight the bad guys, and lo and behold, America would be restored to its pristine state of 1925 or so. Blacks would be back in their place, crime under control, children not smart-assing their parents, and so on. All with no big upset to the lifestyle of Mr. Sunday, New York Times. Yes, he would have related to that, because that resonates with his mentality. But even if I had tried to write a book like that, it wouldn't have had much vitality. I just couldn't put my spirit into something like that. I wrote it the way I did, and some people read it. Not the ones we've been talking about, but other people, and a lot of them. And it knocks them off their chair. They really relate to the book. Damn, this makes sense, they think. And the ideas stick in their minds, and it's not just a momentary thing. They join the National Alliance and go from there, different from the way they'd done things before. So while some people read the Turner Diaries and are horrified, there are many others who are deeply affected by the book. And contrary to what these horrifieds believe, these others and I are not their inferiors. If these horrified people are really going to understand the ideas and incidents in the book, they are going to have to come to grips with the fact that their reaction to these incidents has to do with the limits in their mentality, as much or more than the limits they attribute to my mentality or that of the people who like the book. Of course, many people who don't like it haven't even read the book. They've only heard about it from talking to other people, or they have read about it in the newspaper, or seen references to it on television. But they still think they know about it, and therefore have an opinion about it. Most of them are sheep. They go wherever the rest of the herd is going. They believe whatever the New York Times or the networks or the New Republic tells them they should believe. Whatever the accepted, proper response to the book is, that is where they are. You can bet on it. I have a stack of reviews this thick telling people what the proper response to the book is. Nobody who writes for the mainstream press approves of the book. They all say that this is a terrible book and obviously the work of a madman or, and actually this is more flattering, that this is a very dangerous book. So for the people who make sure they are on the side of those in the know, they are getting some clear direction on what to think about the book and me. Although nobody around here is ever likely to see it, one reviewer from the Johannesburg Star in South Africa wrote what I thought was a decent review of the Turner Diaries. He didn't really approve of the book, but he acknowledged that the book hits the nail on the head about the problems we're facing and that everybody ought to read the book. He said it is a radical book, an extreme book, but it has a lot of very thought-provoking things in it. I like that. At one point in the Turner Diaries, I said to Pierce, you have Jews and near whites, as you call them, out in California being marched off to extermination. People ask me, what is he getting at here? Is this what he wants? Is he advocating this kind of thing? What are you trying to say with that? You've got to remember that the Turner Diaries is a novel. It is fiction. And therefore, by definition, it is not a book of advocacy. What I did try to do, however, is make it realistic. What do these sheltered middle-class consumers think went on over in the Balkans among the Serbs and Bosnians and Muslims? They have tortured and slaughtered each other wholesale over there. What do they think ethnic cleansing is? This is the kind of thing that has been going on since the beginning of time. It is real. It's the way people behave. And just because this crowd has been insulated from these realities doesn't mean they don't exist. Certainly it went on all through World War II, a period of history I personally care a lot about. It is true that everybody has heard about how the Germans cleansed their nation of Jews. In fact, it seems that is all we have heard about, over and over. But what we don't hear about is what happened to the Germans who were expelled from countries like Poland and Czechoslovakia. 2 million Germans died in that process. My point is that this sort of thing has been commonplace in the world. I'm simply reflecting reality. But weren't you afraid that writing a book like this would exile you to the fringe of American life? Marginalize you, make you look like an extremist outside the boundaries of acceptability? I know that if I tell the truth as I see it, I will become a social outcast from the part of society that takes its cues from the authorities and the news media and movie director Steven Spielberg and the rest. I will be cast into the outer darkness. I realize that. But then again, if you yourself write a book that gets outside of today's acceptable discourse and somehow it manages to be published, you'll never get invited to another faculty party. And you'd better already be tenured and tough as leather, as Kevin McDonald, for one, would find. The book ends with Turner's suicide mission destroying the Pentagon with a nuclear bomb. Why did you end the book that way? When I began the tabloid installments that turned out to be the Turner Diaries, I had a situation. That's pretty much it. There was the organization, and it was trying to get rid of the government, and the government was trying to get rid of it. They were fighting each other. How would it go? I imagined some things, but I didn't have the whole thing plotted out. I went chapter by chapter, one chapter per installment. I tried to get one explosive or charged up incident in each episode to keep the readers interested, and I tried to get my lessons in. One of the lessons I tried to get across had to do with responsibility. A person is responsible for his actions, including the failure to act. Earl Turner was a good guy, but he did act irresponsibly when he broke under torture and revealed information about the order instead of taking cyanide, as he had been ordered to do. He broke the rules, and as a consequence, the organization suffered substantial damage. He was sentenced to death for that, and then given a reprieve and given a chance to make up for what he had done. That's the Pentagon mission, the last episode in the book where Turner dies, dropping a nuclear bomb in the Pentagon. Turner saw it as fair and proper that it went that way. The organization was in a precarious situation. The government was getting its act together and eventually would have attacked its enclave in California. The organization had to prevent that, and they did it by destroying the system's command and control center at the Pentagon in Washington. It was really hard to do because the government had cleaned out the whole area around the Pentagon to keep anybody from getting a bomb in there. They had put up blast shutters and beams around the Pentagon and wouldn't let anyone get within 2 miles of the place. They knew the organization had nuclear weapons it had gotten from the Air Force base, so the only way the organization could get a bomb in was through an aerial attack. If they had had high tech and more time, they might have made a remote control bomb, stolen Tomahawk missile or something, but they didn't. So they went the low-tech approach, put the bomb in the back seat of a crop duster, and Turner got in and flew the damn thing into the Pentagon and succeeded in his mission. It was the responsible thing for him to do, and it saved the day, and it made a hero out of him, and I thought it was a good ending for the book. And that's the end of Pierce commenting on Turner Diaries, which is Chapter 11. Now we move on to Chapter 12, Timothy McVeigh. "Of course you will always be linked with Timothy McVeigh," I said to Pierce. "Unfortunately, I've never met Tim McVeigh," he replied, "although I must say it seems that he and Bob Matthews have a lot in common." Bob Matthews, a National Alliance member who was inspired by the Turner Diaries, formed an order of his own in the 1980s with bloody consequences. More on Matthews later. "When you first heard about it, what was your reaction to the bombing at Oklahoma City?" I asked Pierce. It took a while for the facts to become public, so I could start to figure out what happened. I was watching the news one evening, and there was this story about a huge bomb having destroyed a federal building in Oklahoma City. I figured that probably it was a terrorist bomb, so I was very excited. "What does it mean?" I asked myself. "Will there be more bombings?" That's what went through my mind, but I didn't really know what was going on. It took a couple of hours for the date to sink in. April 19th, the second anniversary of the Waco massacre. I thought this was maybe something one of the Christian identity groups had done, because some of those outfits are quite militant. But it turned out to be McVeigh. The Christian identity doctrine holds that God's chosen people are actually ancestors of today's Anglo-Saxons and Scandinavians. Christian identity beliefs are foundational to an extremist group based in Hayden Lake, Idaho, called Aryan Nations. And they were also common among the people who were at Elohim City, where the Oklahoma City was actuated and planned by the Fed's agent provocateur, Andreas Strassmeyer. "Although I have never spoken to McVeigh," Pierce continued, "I have had contact with his lawyer, Steve Jones. That was prior to McVeigh's trial. Jones needed some expert advice, and I hope I helped him. He was concerned that the government would attempt to show that the Turner Diaries gave McVeigh the plan for the bombing. The prosecutors would say, 'Here's the blueprint in this book, and here's a man who is identified with the book. He sold the book at gun shows and told his army buddies to read it, so you can see how it all fits together.' I told Jones I knew he didn't have a lot of time to study the Turner Diaries, so I would point out the connections that the government was making that made no sense, and things in the book and the actual case that were clearly different. For one thing, the government is making a lot out of the fact that the bomb in Oklahoma City went off at something like 9:03 a.m. and the FBI headquarters in the Turner Diaries was bombed at 9:15. It's silly to see any connection there. You mean this guy sitting in front of the federal building in Oklahoma City saying to himself, 'Better not light the fuse yet. Gotta wait until 9:15 because it's right here in the book.' Absurd." I also pointed out to Jones that the bomb used at the FBI headquarters in the Turner Diaries was described in detail in the book, and it was entirely different from the one used in Oklahoma City. The bomb in the book couldn't have been used as a recipe for the Oklahoma City bomb. The one in the book was an ammonium nitrate fertilizer and fuel oil bomb. The one in Oklahoma City consisted of ammonium nitrate fertilizer and nitromethane. Nitromethane is a very powerful liquid explosive. It's used as a rocket fuel and a racing fuel. It's a liquid explosive all by itself, like nitroglycerin, although it is not as sensitive. You can detonate it with a blasting cap or, as McVeigh did, with detonating cord. Nitromethane is nowhere mentioned in the Turner Diaries. Whoever made that bomb for Oklahoma City didn't get the recipe for it from my book. Another thing, the media, and deliberately I believe, misinterpreted my book, and then the government went along with it and linked McVeigh's actions to that misinterpretation, saying he was doing the same thing as the media incorrectly said was in the Turner Diaries. Here's how it worked. The media portrayed the bombing of the FBI building in the Turner Diaries as an attempt to create a lot of casualties, make a big impact, and send a message to the government. Anybody who has read the book with care at all knows that that is not what went on in the book. The motive of the organization in the book was to destroy some computers in the sub-basement of the FBI building that were to be used for an internal passport system the organization was very anxious to avoid. The people who did that bombing in the book lament the fact that so many innocent people were killed in the operation. They agonize over the innocent victims. They weren't trying to kill people or send messages. I told Jones that in all probability the government was going to go with the media's false account of the book and say that McVeigh took his cues from the book and had the same motives. In other words, they would argue that McVeigh was inspired by something that was never actually in the book in the first place. I figured this would happen because I honestly don't believe the government people are capable of thinking in any other way than the way they see things spelled out in the media. They are so socialized, so politicized, that they can be counted on to parrot whatever is put out for public consumption by the media. So I told Jones to watch for that and gave him references in the book to support his points. And sure enough, the government tried to bulldoze through with the "inspired by the Turner Diaries" scenario in their opening arguments, and Jones was ready for them in rebuttal. Griffin, are you saying you seriously have doubts that McVeigh was inspired by your book? Pierce says, I believe he was inspired by the Waco massacre. That really pissed him off. He even traveled down there. What went on in the Turner Diaries had nothing to do with what was apparently his intention, and that was to send the government the message, you can't do that kind of crap you did in Waco because you're going to get hit back. But doesn't it seem very likely that your book gave McVeigh the idea for how to send that message? No. As I said before, he obviously had to know more about making bombs than I wrote about in the Turner Diaries because he had a far more sophisticated bomb. Yes, but the idea of a bomb in a truck. Well, that's just an obvious thing. You don't have to get that from my book. If you want to destroy a large target, you need a large bomb, and the way you get it there is a truck. You don't carry it on your back. That's the way they blew up the Marine barracks in Lebanon, and that's how the U.S. Embassy in Beirut was blown up. When the Jews blew up the King David Hotel in Jerusalem in 1946, they had their explosives in milk cans. So probably what they did was drive up in a truck and carry the milk cans in on a pushcart or something. Tim was much into military matters, and I would imagine he had access to military manuals on how to make a bomb. I understand that they found an envelope with photocopied pages from your book. Quote, they found a Xerox piece of paper that had quotations from several people, and one of them was from the Turner Diaries. But there were also quotations from, Samuel Adams was one of them, I think. Could be. Anyway, some well-known figures who made statements about tyranny and the responsibility of a free man to fight it and so forth. It was just a passage from the Turner Diaries along with other writings. Actually, I felt I was in good company. I think the passage was, I wrote it down, from pages 61 and 62 about how the bureaucrats and politicians are not beyond the reach of retribution for what they do. That could be, Pierce replied. I really don't know the details of it. There are reports that McVeigh was in touch with your organization, the National Alliance, in the weeks before the bombing I offered. There were 5 or 6 telephone calls over a 2-day period from McVeigh or somebody using his telephone credit card to an answering machine we have had in Fort Mojave, Arizona. The calls were made from the motel in Kingman, Arizona, where apparently McVeigh was staying. What you get when you call that number is a 4-minute recorded message and then an opportunity to leave your name and address so we can send you information and a book catalog. You are also given an address where you can write. I don't know whether an address was actually left after the message or whether the member administering the machine for us did anything. What I can't figure out is why anybody would call that number more than once. Why would anybody call our answering service 5 or 6 times? I suppose somebody might call the answering service a second time if he wasn't sure he got the address right the first time, but why call 5 or 6 times? What comes to me is that maybe there were 3 people in the motel, or 4 or 5 over a 2-day period, and McVeigh said, "Hey, you've got to listen to this message, call this number." So one man would call and say, "That's really good," and have another person call it. You have no record McVeigh called here in West Virginia. No, there was a story going around, and it is my suspicion that Morris Dees of the SBLC planted it, that Tim McVeigh called my unlisted number and had a 45-minute conversation with me 2 weeks before the bombing. That isn't true. The FBI has a record of the calls placed from every place they could tie McVeigh to, and none were made to this number. So you never talked to him, and there were no written correspondence, nothing. "We had no prior contact with Tim McVeigh," Pierce answered. "Given what you know about McVeigh, what do you think of him?" I asked. "I've never had contact with him, but I have spoken to several people who have, and they think highly of him. They say he is a young man who behaves like a soldier. He didn't try to wriggle out of this thing. I thought his statement at the end where he quoted Supreme Court Justice Brandeis fit the character of this whole affair very well. Essentially, Brandeis, who was a Jew who was the Supreme Court Justice, in fact, he was the chief Supreme Court Justice, back in, under FDR, I think it was. Essentially, Brandeis said that the government is the teacher of the people and that it teaches by example. If you have a government that is lawless, then you cannot blame the people if they commit lawless acts. If the government wants its people to obey the law, the government has to obey the law. Tim probably has a lot in common with Bob Matthews in that he is a very serious man, and he took what happened in Waco very seriously. It really worried him. He probably thought, my government is out of control. How could they have done what they did? These people in that compound weren't bothering the government. The government just came in and slaughtered them. If they had wanted to arrest this David Koresh, they could have done it easily when he went to town to do his laundry, which he did regularly. They could have gotten his schedule from the local sheriff. But the BATF wanted a media opportunity and said to itself, here's a bunch of crazy cultists who have guns they shouldn't have. We'll make a big deal of this and get all the TV cameras in here, and this will get us all promotions and a bigger appropriation from Congress next year. That is what is going through their minds. They think, if a bunch of people get hurt, who cares? They are not like us. They are somebody else. They have a crazy religion, so screw them. We'll use them to get publicity. But the whole thing backfired. Many people saw that after the fact. Certainly Tim could see it, and he figured that a government that would do a thing like that was really beyond the pale, and that something had to be done to express public outrage. And, like Bob Matthews, when Tim decided that something ought to be done, he didn't leave it to someone else to do it. In your eyes, was McVeigh morally justified in doing what he did? That is a bit complicated. If one is waging a war against the government, civilians are going to be killed. But you have to look at the bigger picture. Let's say you are trying to save our whole race, as Earl Turner was in the Turner Diaries. You know that there are necessarily going to be casualties in the process of doing that, including a lot of innocent people who didn't want to get involved in either side of the conflict. Under a circumstance like that, if it were part of a war, then a bombing of the Oklahoma City sort is morally justified. But if you are going to engage in a war, you have to meet certain requirements. One of them is you have to have a plausible strategy, a plan that can reasonably be argued will get you what you want to achieve. If McVeigh was throwing a single punch to send a message, then its moral justification is debatable. You might well say that this was an overly expensive message in that case. And if McVeigh was in fact inspired by what you wrote, and it seems to me there is a very good chance that he was, would that trouble you? If that was the case, the only thing that would concern me would be the legal aspects of it. I would want to be very careful in the future to have a disclaimer in what I wrote, saying this is fiction and not advocacy. I'd have a lawyer craft something and print it in very small type on the back of the title page. But the fact of the matter is that we are engaged in a war for the survival of our people. In a war, people jump the gun. It's not unusual. Often a war is preceded by border incidents, and something like Oklahoma City could be a border incident. I feel as sorry as anyone else if a little white kid gets killed in one of these things. For that matter, I feel bad if a white kid gets killed in an automobile accident. But I don't advocate that we ban automobiles because people get killed in them, including innocent people who might have grown up to be great scientists or poets. In the same way, I'm not in favor of calling off a war because some border incidents or battles take innocent lives. Actually, the sooner the war to save our people takes place, the better, because even more innocent lives will be lost if we wait. The sooner such a war, the cleaner it will be. It's going to be a mess later on. And that's the end of page 166 and the end of chapter 12 on Tim McVeigh. Thanks for being with me today. Again, you can find everything that we do at vnnforum.com. I'm Alex Linder, and I'll be back with you again real soon.